she crashed through the door, chickens flew out around her. Bruce had his back plastered to the wall beside the door. He was in the grip of savage terror, out of his mind, shrieking like the keeper had him by the toes. Bruce saw her and made to throw his arm around her, but flung himself back against the wall when he saw her bloody face, saw strings of blood dripping from her chin. She seized his shoulder.
"It's Mama. I just fell and hit my nose, that's all."
He threw himself at her, his arms clutching her hips, his fingers snatching at her clothes. Nora twisted around, but even with the bright firelight, she didn't see her daughter.
"Bruce, where's Bethany?"
His arm lifted, shaking so much she feared it would come undone. She wheeled to see where he pointed. Nora screeched. She threw her hands up to cover her face, but couldn't, her fingers quaking violently before her mouth as she screamed with Bruce. Bethany was standing in the hearth, engulfed in flames. The fire roared around her, swirling and tumbling eddies as it consumed her little body. Her arms were lifted out into the angry white heat, the way you lifted your arms into the warm spring afternoon sunlight after a swim. The stink of bubbling, burning flesh suddenly wormed into Nora's bleeding nose, gagging her until she choked on the smell and taste and couldn't get another breath. She couldn't seem to look away from Bethany, look away from her daughter being burned up alive. It didn't seem real. She couldn't make her mind understand it. Nora lunged a step toward the flames to snatch her daughter out of the fire. Something inside, some last scrap of sense, told her it was far too late, told her to get away with Bruce before it had them, too. The tips of Bethany's fingers were all gone. Her face was nothing but yellow-orange whorls of flame. The fire burned with wild, roused, determined fury. The heat sucked Nora's breath from her lungs. A shrill scream suddenly rose from the girl, as if her soul itself had finally caught fire. It made the very marrow in Nora's bones ache. Bethany collapsed in a heap. Flames shot up around the crumbled form, tumbling out around the stone, licking briefly up over the mantel. Sparks splashed out into the room, bouncing and rolling across the floor. Several hissed out against the wet hem of Nora's dress. Nora snatched at Bruce, clutching his nightshirt in a death grip, and ran with him from the house as evil consumed what was left of her daughter. Chapter 19. Fitch folded his legs as he sat on the grass. The cool brick felt good against his sweaty back. He took a deep breath of the sweet-smelling night, the aromas of roasting meat wafting out through the open windows, and the clean smell of the apple wood pile. Since they would be working late, cleaning up the mess after the feast, they'd been given a welcome respite. Morley handed him the bottle. It would be late before they could get good and drunk, but at least they could have a sample. Fitch took a big swig. Instantly, he coughed violently before he could get it down, losing most of the mouthful of liquor. Morley laughed.
"Told you it was strong."
Fitch wiped the back of his sleeve across his dripping chin.
"You're right about that. Where'd you get it? This is good stuff."
Fitch had never had anything so strong that it burned that much going down. From what he'd heard, if it burned, that meant it was good stuff. He'd been told that if he ever had a chance, he'd be a fool to turn down good stuff. He coughed again. The back of his nose, back in his throat, burned something awful. Morley leaned closer.
"Someone important ordered it sent back. Said it was swill. They were trying to be pompous in front of everyone. Pete, the cupbearer, he ran it back and set it down. When he grabbed another and ran out, I snatched it up and slipped it under my tunic before anyone noticed."
Fitch was used to drinking the wine they'd managed to scavenge. He'd drain almost empty small casks and bottles, collecting the dregs and what was left behind. He'd never gotten his hands on any of the scarce liquor before. Morley pushed at the bottom of the bottle, tipping it to Fitch's lips. Fitch took a more cautious pull and got it down without spitting it back out. His stomach felt like a boiling cauldron. Morley nodded approvingly. Fitch smiled with smug pride. Through distant open windows, he could hear people talking and laughing in the gathering hall, waiting for the feast to begin. Fitch could already feel the effects of the liquor. Later, after they cleaned up, they could finish getting drunk. Fitch rubbed the goose flesh on his arms. The music, drifting out from the windows, put him in a mood. Music always did that. Made him feel like he could rise up and do something. He didn't know what, but something, something powerful. When Morley held out his hand, Fitch handed over the bottle. He watched the knob in Morley's throat move up and down with every swallow. The music built with emotion, quickened with excitement. On top of the effects of the drink, it gave him chills. Off past Morley, Fitch saw someone tall coming down the path toward them. The person was walking deliberately, not just out for a stroll, but going someplace. In the yellow lamplight coming from all the windows, Fitch saw the glint off a silver scabbard. He saw the noble features and bearing. It was Dalton Campbell, who was coming right for them. Fitch elbowed his friend and then stood. He steadied himself on his feet before straightening his tunic. The front of it was wet with liquor he'd coughed out. He quickly swiped back his hair. With the side of his foot, he kicked Morley and signaled with a thumb for him to get up. Dalton Campbell walked around the woodpile, headed straight toward them. The tall Ander seemed to know right where he was going. Fitch and Morley, when it was just the two of them lifting drink and sneaking off, never told anyone where they went. "Fitch, Morley," Dalton Campbell called out as he approached.
"Good evening, Master Campbell," Fitch said, raising a hand in greeting.
Fitch guessed what, with the light from the windows, it wasn't really that hard to see. He could see Morley good enough, see him holding the bottle behind his back. It must be that the minister's aide saw them from a window as they were going out to the woodpile.
"Good evening, Master Campbell," Morley said.
Dalton Campbell looked them over like he was inspecting soldiers. He held out his hand.
"May I?"
Morley winced as he pulled the bottle from behind his back and handed it over.
"We was... that is..."
Dalton Campbell took a good swig.
"Ah,"
he said as he handed the bottle back to Morley. "You two are fortunate to have such a good and full bottle of liquor." He clasped his hand behind his back. "I hope I'm not interrupting anything." Both Fitch and Morley, stunned at Dalton Campbell taking a swig of their bottle, and more so that he handed it back, both shook their heads vigorously.
"No, sir, Master Campbell," Morley said.
"Good, then," Campbell said. "I was looking for the two of you. I have a bit of trouble." Fitch leaned a little closer, lowering his voice.
"Trouble, Master Campbell? Is there anything we can do to help?"
Campbell watched Fitch's eyes and then Morley's.
"Well, yes, as a matter of fact, that's why I was looking for you. You see, I thought you two might like a chance to prove yourselves, to begin showing me you have the potential I hope you have. I could take care of it myself, but I thought you two might like to have a chance to do something worthwhile."
Fitch felt like the good spirits themselves had just asked if he'd like a chance to do good. Morley set the bottle down and straightened his shoulders like a soldier going to attention.
"Yes, sir, Master Campbell. I surely would like a chance."
Fitch straightened himself up.
"Me too, Master Campbell. You just name it, and we'd both like a chance to prove to you we're men ready to take responsibility."
"Good, very good," he said as he studied them. He let the silence go on a bit before he spoke again. "This is important. This is very important. I thought about taking it to someone else, someone more experienced, but I decided to give you two a chance to show me you can be trusted."
"Anything, Master Campbell," Fitch said, and he meant it. "You just name it."
Fitch trembled with the excitement of having the chance to prove himself to Dalton Campbell. The music seemed to pump him full of need to do something important.
"The Sovereign is not well," Campbell said.
"That's terrible," Morley said.
"We're sorry," Fitch added.
"Yes, it's a shame, but he is old. Minister Chanbur is still young and vigorous. He's undoubtedly going to be named Sovereign, and it isn't likely to be long. Most of the directors are here to discuss business with us. Seat of the Sovereign business, making inquiries, as it were, while they have the leisure to do so. They want to determine certain facts about the minister. They are looking into his character to see what kind of man he is, to see if he's a man they could support when the time comes."
Fitch snatched a quick glance and saw Morley's wide eyes fixed on Dalton Campbell. Fitch could hardly believe he was hearing such important news from a man as important as this. They were just Hakens, after all. This was the minister's aide, an Ander, an important Ander, telling them about matters of the highest substance.
"Thank the Creator,"
Fitch whispered. "Our minister's finally getting the recognition he deserves."
"Yes," Campbell drawled in an odd way. "Well, the thing is, there are people who would like to prevent the minister from being named Sovereign. These people mean to harm the minister."
"Harm him?"
Morley asked, clearly astonished.
"That's right. You both recall learning how the Sovereign is to be protected, that anything done to protect our Sovereign is a virtue?"
"Yes, sir,"
Morley said.
"Yes, sir," Fitch echoed. "And since the minister is to be Sovereign, then he should be protected just the same."
"Very good, Fitch."
Fitch beamed with pride. He wished the drink didn't make it so hard to focus his eyes.
"Master Campbell," Morley said,
We'd like to help. We'd like to prove ourselves to you. We're ready.
Yes, sir, we surely are,
Fitch added. I shall give you both your chance, then. If you can do right, keep silent about it, no matter what, and that means to your graves, I will be pleased my faith in you was well placed.
To our graves, Fitch said. Yes, sir, we can do that.
Fitch heard an odd metallic sound. He realized with horror that there was a sword point under his chin. But if either of you fails to live up to my faith, I would be very disappointed, because the minister would then be in danger, you understand. I won't have people I trust let me down, let the future sovereign down. You both understand?
Yes, sir,
Fitch nearly shouted. The sword point flashed to Morley's throat, poised before the prominent bump in his gullet.
Yes, sir,
he said. Did either of you tell anyone where you would be tonight having your drink?
No, sir,
Morley and Fitch said as one. Yet I knew where to find you. The tall Ander lifted an eyebrow. You just remember that. If you ever think to get it in your head that you could hide from me, if you ever cause me trouble, I will find you no matter where you go to ground.
Master Campbell,
Fitch said after he swallowed, you just tell us what it is we can do to help and we'll do it. We can be trusted. We'll not let you down, I swear. Morley was nodding.
That's right. Fitch is right.
Dalton Campbell slid his sword back into its scabbard and smiled.
I'm already proud of you both.
You two are going to advance around here. I just know you will prove my faith in you.
Yes, sir, Fitch said. You can count on us both.
Dalton Campbell put one hand on Fitch's shoulder and the other on Morley's.
All right, then. You listen close now.
Here she comes,
Morley whispered in Fitch's ear. Fitch nodded after looking where his friend pointed. Morley moved off to the black maw of the open service doors, while Fitch squatted down behind some barrels stacked to the side of a loading dock. Fitch recalled earlier in the day seeing Brownie standing with a butcher's cart across the way. He wiped the palms of his hands on his trousers. It had been a day of important events. They'd talked about it on the way over, and Morley felt the same way. As much as the idea of it had Fitch's heart hammering against his ribs, there was no way he was going to let Dalton Campbell's faith in him be spoiled. Morley thought the same. The music coming from the open windows across the lawn, strings and horns and a harp, was filling his head with purpose, swelling his chest with pride to be chosen by Dalton Campbell. The minister, the future sovereign, had to be protected. Quietly, with light steps, she climbed the four steps up onto the dock. In the dim light, she looked around at the deep shadows, stretching her neck to peer about. Fitch swallowed at how good-looking she was. She was older, but she was a looker. He'd never looked so long and hard at an Ander lady as he did at her. Morley made his voice come out deep in order to sound older.
Claudine Winthrop!
She wheeled expectantly toward Fitch's friend, standing in the dark doorway.
I'm Claudine Winthrop, she whispered. You received my message, then?
Yes, Morley said.
Thank the Creator. Director Linscott, it's important I speak with you about Minister Chanbur. He pretends to uphold Andorath culture, but he is the worst example we could have in his post or any other. Before you consider his name for a future sovereign, you must hear of his corruption. The pig forced himself on me, raped me. But that is only the beginning of it. It gets worse. For the sake of our people, you must hear my words.
Fitch watched as she stood with the soft yellow light from the windows falling across her pretty face. Dalton Campbell hadn't said she was going to be so pretty. She was older, of course, and so not someone he ordinarily thought of as pretty. It surprised him to realize he was thinking of someone so old, she looked almost 30, as attractive. He took a slow, silent breath, trying to tighten his resolve. But he couldn't help staring at what she wore, or more accurately, at where she wasn't wearing anything. Fitch recalled the two women in the stairwell talking about such dresses as the one Claudine Winthrop wore now. Fitch had never seen so much of a woman's breasts. The way they heaved as she wrung her hands had his eyes popping.
Won't you come out?
She asked in a whisper toward the darkness where Morley waited.
Please, I'm frightened.
Fitch suddenly realized he was supposed to be doing his part. He sneaked out from behind the barrels, taking careful steps so she wouldn't hear him coming. His stomach felt like it was in a knot. He had to wipe the sweat out of his eyes in order to see. He tried to breathe calmly, but his heart seemed to have a mind of its own. He had to do this. But dear spirits, he was more than afraid.
Director Linscott,
she whispered toward Morley. Fitch snatched her elbows and wrenched her arms behind her back. She gasped. He was surprised at how easy it was for him to keep her arms pinned behind her as she struggled with all her might. She was confused and startled. Morley shot out from the dark once he saw that Fitch had her. Before she could get much of a scream out, Morley slugged her in the gut as hard as he could. The powerful blow nearly knocked both her and Fitch from their feet. Claudine Winthrop doubled over, vomit spewing all over the dock. Fitch let go of her arms. She crossed them over her middle as she went to her knees, heaving violently. Both he and Morley stepped back as it splashed the dock in her dress, but they weren't about to get more than an arm's length away from her. After a few long convulsions, she straightened, seeming to have finished, and tried to get her feet as she struggled and gasped for breath. Morley lifted her and spun her around. With his powerful grip, he locked her arms behind her back. Fitch knew this was his chance to prove himself. This was his chance to protect the minister. This was his chance to make Dalton Campbell proud. Fitch punched her in the stomach as hard as he dared. He'd never punched anyone before, except his friends, and that was only in fun. Never like this, not for real, not deliberately to hurt someone. Her middle was small and soft. He could see how much his fist had hurt her. It made him feel sick, made him feel like throwing up too. This was the violent way his Haken ancestors behaved. This was what was so terrible about them, about him. Her eyes were wide with terror as she tried over and over to suck in a breath, but couldn't seem to. She fought desperately to get her wind as her eyes fixed on him, like a hog watching the butcher, like her Ander ancestors used to watch his. "We are here to give you a message," Fitch said. They'd agreed Fitch would do the talking. Morley didn't remember so well what they were to tell Claudine Winthrop. Fitch had always been better at remembering. She finally got her breath back. Fitch hunched forward and landed three blows, quick, hard, angry. "Are you listening?" he growled. "You little Haken bastard!" Fitch let go with all his strength. The wallop hurt his fist. It staggered even Morley back a step. She hung forward in Morley's grip as she vomited in dry heaves. Fitch had wanted to hit her face, punch her in the mouth, but Dalton Campbell had given them clear instructions to only hit her where it wouldn't show.
"I'd not call him that again, were I you."
Morley grabbed a fistful of her hair and savagely yanked her up straight. Arching her up so forcefully made her breasts pop out of the top of her dress. Fitch froze. He wondered if he should pull the front of her dress back up for her. His jaw hung as he stared at her. Morley leaned over her shoulder for a look. He grinned at Fitch. She glanced down to see herself spilled out of her dress. Seeing it, she put her head back and closed her eyes in resignation.
"Please," she said, panting for breath toward the sky. "Don't hurt me anymore."
"Are you ready to listen?" she nodded.
"Yes, sir."
That surprised Fitch even more than seeing her naked breasts. No one in his whole life had ever called him sir. Those two meek words felt so strange to his ears that he just stood there staring at her. For a moment, he wondered if she was mocking him. As she looked him in the eye, her expression told him she wasn't. The music was filling him with such feelings as he'd never had before. He'd never been important before, never been called sir before. That morning, he'd been called Fetch. Now, an Ander woman called him sir, all thanks to Dalton Campbell. Fitch punched her in the gut again, just because he felt like it.
"Please, sir," she cried. "Please, no more. Tell me what you want. I'll do it. If you wish to have me, I'll submit. Just don't hurt me anymore. Please, sir."
Although Fitch's stomach still felt heavy with queasy disgust at what he was doing, he also felt more important than he'd ever felt before. Her, an Ander woman with her breasts exposed to him like that, and her calling him sir.
"Now, you listen to me, you filthy little bitch."
His own words surprised him as much as they surprised her. Fitch hadn't planned them. They just came out. He liked the sound of it, though.
"Yes, sir,"
she wept.
"I will. I'll listen, whatever you say."
She looked so pitiful, so helpless. Not an hour ago, if an Ander woman, even this Claudine Winthrop, would have told him to get down on his knees and clean the floor with his tongue, he'd have done it and been trembling at the same time. He'd never imagined how easy this would be. A few punches, and she was begging to do as he said. He never imagined how easy it would be to be important, to have people do as he said. Fitch remembered what it was Dalton Campbell told him to say.
"You were strutting yourself before the minister, weren't you? You were offering yourself to him, weren't you?"
He'd made it clear it wasn't really a question.
"Yes, sir."
If you ever again think of telling anyone the minister raped you, you'll be sorry. Saying such a lie is treason. Got that? Treason. The penalty for treason is death. When they find your body, no one will even be able to recognize you. Do you understand, bitch? They'll find your tongue nailed to a tree. It's a lie that the minister raped you. A filthy, treasonous lie. You ever say such a thing again, and you'll be made to suffer before you die.
Yes, sir, she sobbed. I'll never lie again. I'm sorry. Please, forgive me. I'll never lie again, I swear.
You are putting it out there for the minister, offering yourself. But the minister is a better man than to have an affair with you or anyone. He turns you down. He refused you.
Yes, sir.
Nothing improper happened. Got that? The minister never did nothing improper with you or anyone.
Yes, sir.
She whined in a long sob, her head hanging. Fitch pulled her handkerchief from her sleeve. He dabbed it at her eyes. He could tell in the dim light that her face paint, what with the throwing up and crying, was a shambles.
Stop crying now. You're making a mess of your face. You better go back to your room and fix yourself up before you go back to the feast.
She sniffled, trying to stop the tears.
I can't go back to the feast now. My dress is spoiled. I can't go back.
You can, and you will. Fix your face and put on another dress. You're going to go back. There will be someone watching to see if you go back, to see if you got the message. If you ever slip again, you'll be swallowing the steel of his sword.
Her eyes widened with fright.
Who? That's not important. It don't matter none to you. The only thing that matters is that you got the message and understand what will happen if you ever again tell your filthy lies.
She nodded.
I understand.
Sir,
Fitch said. Her brow twitched.
I understand, sir.
She pressed back against Morley.
I understand, sir. Yes, sir, I truly understand.
Good,
Fitch said. She glanced down at herself. Her lower lip trembled. Tears ran down her cheeks.
Please, sir, may I fix my dress?
When I'm done talking.
Yes, sir.
You've been out for a walk. You didn't talk to no one. You understand? No one. From now on, you just keep your mouth shut about the minister. For when you open it the next time, you'll find a sword going down your throat. Got all that?
Yes, sir.
All right, then,
Fitch gestured.
Go ahead and pull up your dress.
Morley leered over her shoulder as she stuffed herself back in the dress. Fitch didn't think covering herself with the dress, as low as it was, showed much less, but he surely enjoyed standing there watching her do it. He never thought he'd see such a thing, especially an Ander woman doing such a thing. The way she straightened with a gasp, Morley must have done something behind her, up under her dress. Fitch surely wanted to do something, too, but remembered Dalton Campbell. Fitch grabbed Claudine Winthrop's arm and pulled her head a couple of steps.
You be on your way now.
She snatched a quick glance at Morley, then looked back at Fitch.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
She dipped a hasty curtsy.
Thank you, sir.
Without further word, she clutched her skirts in her fists, rushed down the steps, and ran off across the lawn into the night.
Why'd you send her off?
Morley asked. He put a hand on his hip.
We could have had that time with her. She'd have had to do anything we wanted. And after a look at what she had, I wanted.
Fitch leaned toward his disgruntled friend.
Because Master Campbell never told us we could do anything like that. That's why we was helping Master Campbell, and that's all, no more.
Morley made a sour face.
I guess.
He looked off toward the woodpile.
We still got a lot of drinking to do.
Fitch thought about the look of fear on Claudine Winthrop's face. He thought about her crying and sobbing. He knew Haken women cried, of course, but Fitch had never before even imagined an Ander woman crying. Didn't know why not, but he never had. The minister was Ander, so Fitch guessed he couldn't really do wrong. She must have asked for it with her low-cut dress and the way she acted toward him. Fitch had seen the way a lot of women acted toward him, like they would rejoice if he had them. He remembered Beata sitting on the floor crying. He thought about the look of misery on Beata's face up there when the minister threw her out after he'd finished with her. Fitch thought about the way she'd clouded him. It was all too much for him to figure out. Fitch wanted nothing more right then than to drink himself into a stupor.
You're right. Let's go have ourselves a drink. We've a lot to celebrate. Tonight we became important men.
with an arm over each other's shoulders, they headed for their bottle. Chapter 20.
Well, isn't that something?
Teresa whispered. Dalton followed her gaze to see Claudine Winthrop haltingly work her way among the roomful of milling people. She was wearing a dress he had seen before when he worked in the city, an older dress of modest design. It was not the dress she had worn earlier in the evening. He suspected that beneath the mask of rosy powder, her face was ashen. Mistrust would now color her vision. People from the city of Fairfield, their eyes filled with wonder, gazed at their surroundings, trying to drink it all in so they might tell their friends every detail of the grand evening at the Minister of Culture's estate. It was a high honor to be invited to the estate, and they wished to overlook no detail. Details were important when vaunting oneself. Patches of intricate marquetry flooring showed between each of the richly colored rare carpets placed at even intervals the length of the room. There was no missing the luxuriously thick feel underfoot. Dalton guessed that thousands of yards of the finest material had to have gone into the draperies, swagged before the file of tall windows on each side of the room, all constructed with complex ornamental tracery to hold colored glass. Here and there a woman would, between thumb and finger, test the cloth's high-count weave. The edges of the azure and gold wheat-colored fabric were embellished with multicolored tassels as big as his fist. Men marveled at the fluted stone columns rising to hold a massive, cut stone corbel along the length of the sidewalls at the base of the gathering hall's barrel ceiling, a panoply of curved mahogany frames and panels, looking like the ends of elaborately cut voussoirs, overspread the arched barrel ceiling. Dalton lifted his pewter cup to his lips and took a sip of the finest Narif Valley wine as he watched. At night, with all the candles and lamps lit, the place had a glow about it. It had taken discipline when he first arrived, not to gape as did these people come out from the city. He watched Claudine Winthrop move among the well-dressed guests, clasping a hand here, touching an elbow there, greeting people, smiling woodenly, answering questions with words Dalton couldn't hear. As distressed as he knew she had to be, she had the resourcefulness to conduct herself with propriety. The wife of a wealthy businessman who had been elected burgess by merchants and grain dealers to represent them, she was not an unimportant member of the household in her own right. When at first people saw that her husband was old enough to be her grandfather, they usually expected she was no more than his entertainment. They were wrong. Her husband, Edwin Winthrop, had started out as a farmer raising sorgho, sweet sorghum grown widely in southern Andorath. Every penny he earned through the sale of the sorghum molasses he pressed was spent frugally and wisely. He went without, putting in abeyance everything from proper shelter and clothes to the simple comforts of life to a wife and family. What money he saved eventually purchased livestock he foraged on sorghum left from pressing his molasses. Sale of fattened livestock, bought more feeder stock and equipment for stills so he could produce rum himself, rather than sell his molasses to distilleries. Profits from the rum he distilled from his molasses earned him enough to rent more farmland and purchase cattle, equipment, and buildings for producing more rum, and eventually warehouses and wagons for transporting the goods he produced. Rum distilled by the Winthrop Farms was sold from Renwald to Nicobarisi, from just down the road in Fairfield all the way to Aidendrill. By doing everything himself, or more accurately, having his own hired workers do everything, from growing sorgho, to pressing it, to distilling it, to delivering the rum, to raising cattle on the fodder of his leftover stocks of pressed sorghum, to slaughtering the cattle and delivering the carcasses to butchers, Edwin Winthrop kept his costs low and made for himself a fortune. Edwin Winthrop was a frugal man, honest and well-liked. Only after he was successful had he taken a wife. Claudine, the well-educated daughter of a grain dealer, had been in her mid-teens when she wed Edwin well over a decade before. Talented at overseeing her husband's accounts and records, Claudine watched every penny as carefully as would her husband. She was his valuable right hand, much as Dalton served the minister. With her help, his personal empire had doubled. Even in marriage, Edwin had chosen carefully and wisely. A man who never seemed to seek personal pleasure perhaps had at last allowed himself this much. Claudine was as attractive as she was diligent. After Edwin's fellow merchants had elected him burgess, Claudine became useful to him in legal matters, helping behind the scenes to write the trade laws he proposed. Dalton suspected she had a great deal to do with proposing them to her husband in the first place. When he was not available, Claudine discreetly argued those proposed laws on his behalf. No one in the household thought of her as entertainment, except perhaps Bertrand Chambour. But then he viewed all women in that light, the attractive ones anyway. Dalton had in the past seen Claudine blushing, batting her eyelashes, and flashing Bertrand Chambour her shy smile. The minister believed demure women coquettish. Perhaps she innocently flirted with an important man, or perhaps she had wanted attention her husband couldn't provide. She hadn't, after all, any children. Perhaps she had cunningly thought to gain some favor from the minister, and afterward discovered it wasn't to be forthcoming. Claudine Winthrop was nobody's fool. She was intelligent and resourceful. How it had started, Dalton was not sure. Bertrand Chambour denied touching her, as he denied everything out of hand, had become irrelevant. With her seeking secret meetings with Director Linscott, matters had moved past polite negotiation of favors. Brute force was the only safe way to control her now. Dalton gestured with his cup of wine toward Claudine. "Looks like you were wrong, Tess. Not everyone is going along with the fashion of wearing suggestive dresses. Or maybe Claudine is modest."
"No, it must be something else."
Teresa looked truly puzzled.
"Sweetheart, I don't think she was wearing that dress earlier."
"But why would she now be wearing something different?
And an old dress it is."
Dalton shrugged. "Let's go find out, shall we? You do the asking. I don't think it would be right coming from me." Teresa looked askance at him. She knew him well enough to know by his subtle reply that a scheme was afoot. She also knew enough to take his lead and play the part he had just assigned her. She smiled and hooked a hand over his offered arm. Claudine was not the only intelligent and resourceful woman in the household. Claudine flinched when Teresa touched the back of her shoulder. She twitched a smile as she glanced up briefly.
"Good evening, Teresa." She dropped a half-curtsy to Dalton. "Mr. Campbell?"
Teresa, concern creasing her brow, leaned toward the woman.
"Claudine, what's wrong? You don't look well. And your dress, why, I don't recall you coming in wearing this."
Claudine pulled a lock of hair over her ear.
"I'm fine. I was just nervous about all the guests. Sometimes crowds get my stomach worked up. I went for a walk to get some air. In the dark, I guess I put my foot in a hole or something. I fell."
"Dear spirits, would you like to sit?"
Dalton asked as he took the woman's elbow as if to hold her up.
"Here, let me help you to a chair."
She dug in her heels.
"No, I'm fine. But thank you. I soiled my dress and had to go change, that's all. That's why it's not the same one, but I'm fine."
She glanced at his sword as he pulled back. He had seen her looking at a lot of swords since she returned to the gathering hall.
"You look as if something is..."
"No," she insisted. "I hit my head. That's why I look so shaken. I'm fine, really. It simply shook my confidence."
"I understand," Dalton said sympathetically.
"Things like that make one realize how short life can be. Make you realize how..."
He snapped his fingers.
"You could go at any time."
Her lip trembled. She had to swallow before she could speak.
"Yes, I see what you mean. But I feel much better now. My balance is back."
"Is it now? I'm not so sure."
Teresa pushed at him.
"Dalton, can't you see the poor woman is shaken?"
She gave him another push.
"Go on and talk your business while I see to poor Claudine."
Dalton bowed and moved off to allow Teresa some privacy to find out what she would. He was pleased with the two Haken boys. It looked as if they had put the fear of the keeper into her. By the unsteady way she walked, they had obviously delivered the message in the way he had wanted it delivered. Violence always helped people understand instructions. He was gratified to know he had judged Fitch correctly. The way the boy stared at Dalton's sword, he knew. Claudine's eyes reflected fear when she looked at his sword. Fitch's eyes held lust. The boy had ambition. Morley was useful, too, but mostly as muscle. His head, too, was not much more than muscle. Fitch understood instructions better, and as eager as he was, would be of more use. At that age, they had no clue how much they didn't know. Dalton shook hands with a man who rushed up to pay him a compliment about his new position. He presented a civil face, but didn't remember the man's name, or really hear the effusive praise. Dalton's attention was elsewhere. Director Linscott was just finishing speaking with a stocky man about taxes on the wheat stored in the man's warehouses. No trifling matter, considering the vast stores of grain Andereth held. Dalton politely, distantly extracted himself from the nameless man and sidled closer to Linscott. When the director turned, Dalton smiled warmly at him and clasped his hand before he had a chance to withdraw it. He had a powerful grip. His hand still bore the calluses of his life's work.
"I'm so glad you could make it to the feast, Director Linscott. I pray you are enjoying the evening so far. We yet have much the minister would like to discuss."
Director Linscott, a tall, wiry fellow, with a sun-rumpled face invariably looking as if he were plagued by an everlasting toothache, didn't return the smile. The four oldest directors were guild masters. One was from the important cloth-making guild, one from the associated paper-making guild, another a master armorer, and Linscott. Linscott was a master mason. Most of the remaining directors were respected moneylenders or merchants, along with a solicitor and several barristers. Director Linscott's surcoat was an outdated cut, but finely kept nonetheless, and the warm brown went well with the man's thin gray hair. His sword, too, was old, but the leather scabbard's exquisite brassware at the throat and tip was in gleaming condition. The silver emblem, the mason's dividers, stood out in bright silhouette against the dark leather. The sword's blade, undoubtedly, would be just as well maintained as everything else about the man. Linscott didn't deliberately try to intimidate people. It just seemed to come naturally to him, the way a surly disposition came naturally to a mother brown bear with cubs. Linscott considered the Andereth people, those working fields or hauling nets, or at employment in a trade through a guild hall, his cubs.
"Yes," Linscott said. "I hear rumors the minister has grand plans. I hear he has thoughts of disregarding the strong advice of the Mother Confessor and breaking with the Midlands."
Dalton spread his hands. "I am sure I don't speak out of turn when I tell you from my knowledge of the situation that Minister Chanbor intends to seek the best terms for our people, nothing more, nothing less. You, for instance, what if we were to surrender to the new Lord Rawl and join the Dharan Empire? This Lord Rawl has decreed all lands must surrender their sovereignty, unlike our alliance with Midlands. That would mean, I suppose, he would no longer have need for directors of cultural amity."
Linscott's tanned face turned ruddy with heat. "This isn't about me, Campbell. It's about the freedom of the people of the Midlands, about their future, about not being swallowed up and having our land brutalized by a rampaging Imperial Order army bent on the conquest of the Midlands. The Andereth ambassador has relayed Lord Rawl's word that while all lands must surrender to him and be brought under one rule and one command, each land will be allowed to retain its culture, so long as we do not break laws common to all. He has promised that if we accept his entreaty while the invitation is still open to all, we will be party to creating those common laws. The Mother Confessor has put her word to his."
Dalton respectfully bowed his head to the man. "You misunderstand Minister Chanbor's position, I'm afraid. He will propose to the sovereign we go with the Mother Confessor's advice if he sincerely believes it to be in the best interest of our people. Our very culture is at stake, after all. He has no wish to choose sides prematurely. The Imperial Order may offer our best prospects for peace. The minister wants only peace."
The director's dark scowl seemed to chill the air. "Slaves have peace."
Dalton affected an innocent, helpless look.
"I am no match for your quick wit, Director."
"You seem ready to sell your own culture, Campbell, for the empty promises of an invading horde obsessed with conquest. Ask yourself, why else have they come uninvited? How can you so smoothly proclaim you are considering thrusting a knife into the heart of the Midlands? What kind of man are you, Campbell? After all they've done for us, to turn your back on the advice and urging of our Mother Confessor?"
"Director, I think you..."
Linscott shook his fist.
"Our ancestors, who fought so futilely against the Haken Horde, no doubt shiver in their eternal rest to hear you so smoothly consider bargaining away their sacrifice and our heritage."
Dalton paused, letting Linscott hear his own words fill the silence and echo between the two of them. It was for this harvest Dalton had sowed his seeds of words.
"I know you are sincere, Director, in your fierce love of our people, and in your unflinching desire to protect them. I am sorry you find my wish for the same insincere."
Dalton bowed politely.
"I pray you enjoy the rest of the evening."
To graciously accept such an insult was the pinnacle of courtesy. But more than that, it revealed the one who would inflict such wounds as beneath the ancient ideals of Ander honor. Only Hakens were said to be so cruelly demeaning to Anders. With the utmost respect for the one who had insulted him, Dalton turned away as if he had been asked to leave, as if he had been driven off, as if he had been humiliated by a Haken overlord. The director called his name. Dalton paused and looked back over his shoulder. Director Linscott screwed up his mouth, as if loosening it to test rarely used courtesy.
"You know, Dalton, I remember you when you were with the magistrate in Fairfield. I always believed you were a moral man. I don't now believe differently."
Dalton cautiously turned around, presenting himself as if he were prepared to accept another insult should the man wish to deliver one.
"Thank you, Director Linscott. Coming from a man as respected as you, that is quite gratifying."
Linscott gestured in a casual manner, as if still brushing at cobwebs in the dark corners in his search for polite words.
"So I'm at a loss to understand how a moral man could allow his wife to parade around showing off her teats like that."
Dalton smiled. The tone, if not the words themselves, had been conciliatory. Casually, he stepped closer. He caught a full cup of wine from a passing tray and offered it to the director. Linscott took the cup with a nod. Dalton dropped his official tone and spoke as if he had been boyhood chums with the man.
"Actually, I couldn't agree more. In fact, my wife and I had an argument about it before we came down tonight. She insisted the dress was the fashion. I put my foot down, as the man of the marriage, and unconditionally forbade her from wearing the dress."
"Then why is she wearing it?"
Dalton sighed wearily.
"Because I don't cheat on her."
Linscott cocked his head.
"Well, I am glad to hear you don't ascribe to the seeming new moral attitudes where indulgences are concerned. What has that to do with the price of wheat in Kelton?"
Dalton took a sip of his wine. Linscott followed his lead.
"Well, since I don't cheat on her, I'd have no play in bed if I won every argument."
For the first time, the director's face took on a small smile.
"I see what you mean.
The younger women around here dress in an appealing fashion. I was shocked when I came here to work. My wife is younger, though, and wishes to fit in with them, to have friends. She fears being shunned by the other women of the household. I have spoken with the minister about it, and he agrees that women should not flaunt themselves in such a manner. But our culture grants to women prerogative over their own dress. The minister and I believe that, together, we might think of a way to influence fashion to the better."
Linscott nodded approvingly.
"Oh, I have a wife, too, and I don't cheat either. I'm glad to hear you are one of the few today who adheres to the old ideals that an oath is sacred and commitment to your mate is sacrosanct. Good man."
Andereth culture revolved a great deal around honor and word given in solemn oath, about holding to your pledge. But Andereth was changing. It was a matter of great concern to many that moral bounds had, over the last few decades, fallen to scorn by many. Debauchery was not only accepted, but expected among the fashionable elite. Dalton glanced over at Teresa, back at the director, and to Teresa again. He held out a hand.
"Director, could I introduce you to my lovely wife, please? I would consider it a personal favor if you lent your considerable influence to the issue of decency. You are a greatly respected man, and could speak with moral authority I could never begin to command. She thinks I speak only as a jealous husband."
Linscott considered only briefly.
"I would, if it would please you."
Teresa was encouraging Claudine to drink some wine, and was offering comforting words as Dalton shepherded the director up beside the two women.
"Teresa, Claudine, may I introduce Director Linscott?"
Teresa smiled into his eyes as he lightly kissed her hand. Claudine stared at the floor as the procedure was repeated on her hand. She looked as if she wanted nothing more than to either jump into the man's arms for protection or run away as fast as she could. Dalton's reassuring hand on her shoulder prevented either.
"Teresa, darling, the director and I were just discussing the issue of the women's dresses and fashion versus decorum."
Teresa canted a shoulder toward the director, as if taking him into her confidence.
"My husband is so stuffy about what I wear. And what do you think, Director Linscott? Do you approve of my dress?"
Teresa beamed proudly.
"Do you like it?"